as it occurred, while the occupation army was busy analyzing the attacks with IEDs that targeted enemy vehicles in Jenin a day before, resulting in many casualties and in many losses. Now, let us start with Jenin to begin with. How do you assess the maybe the heroic fight which was showcased by the resistance fighters themselves inside of Jenin?
There is no doubt that there were three stages in which the Palestinian resistance developed in the city of Jenin, especially the Jenin Battalion of the Al-Quds Brigades, the military wing of the Islamic Jihad movement. This battalion moved from the stage of defending the city, the countryside and the camp in Jenin, to the stage of attacking the settlements surrounding the city of Jenin. In addition to the stationing of occupation soldiers at checkpoints, military crossings and surrounding camps in the city and the camp itself. Now the third stage is that of the usage of new types of weapons in the face of the occupation when it entered the city of Jenin. What really sets this process apart is more than one issue. The first issue is that it came at a time when the occupation did not imagine the existence of explosive devices of this size. The Israeli Shin Bet said, "We had no information about the use of such explosive devices by the Al-Quds Brigades or any other resistance faction." So the first point was the element of surprise that was presented in this battle, that Al-Quds Brigades called the Firmness of the Free, calling it that after its sister battle in Gaza, which lasted for 5 days and was called Revenge of the Free. The second point is the development of improvised explosive devices. In other words, there are new experiences among the Palestinian resistance in Jenin. Israel accuses the resistance movements in Gaza, in addition to Hezbollah and the Islamic Republic of Iran, of having a direct relationship in developing these devices, or transferring the techniques of developing these devices to what the Al-Quds Brigades called the Tamer devices. Based on the increasing war effort of the Jenin Battalion and the resistance factions and the use of the element of surprise, this was a heavy blow to the occupation army, which prompted it to retreat to the use of special forces and the land army of the occupation army in Jenin, and to rely on other methods to reduce losses when they entered Jenin. We noticed this when they used the attack drone that targeted three Jenin battalion fighters who were martyred in this strike.
Well, Mr. Saleh, the Ali operation was also carried out by the Al-Qassam Brigades, the military wing of the Hamas resistance movement. In response to the Jenin massacre committed by the occupation forces a day before, which resulted in the fall of six martyrs, in addition to another young man who was martyred in the town of Husan near Bethlehem. So using an M16 weapon on a number of settlers who were eliminated in southern Nablus, the fighters, the resistance fighters who did the operation, fled the scene at first, then they were captured and martyred. But what was the impact of such an operation on the Zionist security apparatus itself?
There is a talk among the security and military establishment inside Israel that there is a difference between what is happening in 2023 and between the second intifada of the Palestinian resistance factions. In other words, the Palestinian resistance factions previously in the Second Intifada used to adopt the mechanism of large groups. These groups have a structure in the organizational network. There was a leader, deputy commander, soldiers and officers in every resistance faction, whether Hamas or the Islamic Jihad. But what happened from May 2021 until this moment is that the Palestinian resistance factions relied on small groups. In other words, very small groups carry out painful operations, as the Al-Qassam Brigades recently carried out in the Ali settlement, and it had this huge effect. Now, what the Israeli military establishment is talking about is that the difference between the two faces, the face of the Second Intifada and the current face of the resistance factions, is the difficulty of tracking these groups. I mean, we do not follow one group from Islamic Jihad. We do not follow one group for Hamas. We do not follow one group for Fatah. We are following tens or even hundreds of cells affiliated with each resistance faction. Thus, the imbalance is exhausting the enemy financially, militarily, and at security and intelligence levels. On the other hand, the importance of this operation appears that it came as a quick response in less than 24 hours to the Jenin massacre. In other words, in the West Bank, there is a kind of balance between the Israeli crime and the response to it by the Palestinian resistance. We saw this in dozens of massacres committed by the occupying entity, and in the direct Palestinian response to them, the latest of which was the operation of the Ali settlement north of Ramallah.
Well, in less than a minute, Mr. Saleh, the Israeli conservatives, the extremists in Israel, they keep threatening or asking the Israeli regime to start a large-scale operation. But do you think that the Israeli entity can risk a large-scale operation in the West Bank, which most probably will kick-start a third intifada?
It is confirmed that Israel will not move, according to our analysis, towards a comprehensive operation similar to Operation Defensive Shield in 2002. This is for many reasons. The first of which is the international and regional changes that do not help Israel in going through such a process. The second point, Israel does not want to weaken the Palestinian Authority. Yesterday, there was a statement by Netanyahu in which he said that the Palestinian Authority is required of us to support it as Israelis and as an Israeli government, even financially, to carry out issues in which it replaces Israel's role when carrying it out. Therefore, Israel does not want to weaken the PA. The third and most important point is that the variety of resistance cells planted in the northern occupied West Bank makes the policy of mowing the lawn that the Israeli has been following since 2021 the safest way for the Israeli entity and the occupation army, along with info that there is an escalation in Operation Breaking Waves, which was launched in March 2022, which will be the direction of the occupation army through three main issues, which are the increase in arrests amongst the Palestinians, the increase in attacks on military cells, and thirdly, the use of the air force through bomber drones to target resistance fighters.
Well, we have to see if Israel can actually succeed in that and not kickstart a third intifada, which everyone was actually talking about. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Saleh Abu Azze, political commentator and researcher from Jenin, for joining us right here in Beirut. Now, ladies and gents, please stay tuned, because next we are going to talk about the explosion that rocked Herzliya.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, Herzliya settlement in Tel Aviv was rocked by a large explosion at the site of an old munitions plant. 3 tons of explosives are said to have exploded after allegedly insulation in the munition warehouse deteriorated. Herzliya municipality is now urging Zionist authorities to close the munition site, with the mayor of the settlement warning of ticking time bombs in their settlement. Was it really a hazardous accident, or was it something else? More details in the following report.
A massive explosion rocked the site of a former arms industry factory in the Herzliya area in occupied Jaffa, also known as Tel Aviv, late June 22nd, prompting the Zionist regime to instruct colonial settlers in the area to close their windows and stay inside to protect against hazardous gases that the blast may have discharged. Israeli entity media claimed the explosion was reportedly caused by improperly stored gunpowder from an old ammunition factory, without giving further details. There were no immediate reports of casualties or significant damage in connection with the explosion, and aside from the potential threat posed by hazardous gases, there was no indication of any danger facing individuals or property in the affected area in the aftermath of the incident. Although the cause of the blast was not immediately reported, the Israeli occupation forces asserted in a statement that military activity was not responsible for the explosion. Traffic was disrupted in the affected area days after the explosion as occupation authorities continued their investigation into the incident, which reportedly created a crater 7 meters deep. Zionist Channel 12 confirmed on Friday that the huge explosion that occurred in Hezirlia was due to an underground store containing 3 tons of explosive materials, and that its source was a facility of a military industries company in the city itself. Channel 12 News also reported that the explosion took place in an unpopulated sandy area in an industrial part of town, which allegedly occurred due to deteriorating insulation material placed over explosives that were buried after the old plant was shut down some 25 years ago. The explosion was heard across central occupied Palestine in settlements like Ramat Gan, Givatayim, Kiryat Ono, Hod HaSharon, and Rosh Hayin. Settlers of Herzliya also reported an unusual odor following the blast and a substance in the air that caused a burning sensation in the eyes. It was also reported that Herzliya municipality asked the Zionist security establishment to seal off the area and conduct a probe of the explosive materials that remained there. Zionist Army Radio also said that the area was known to have explosives and that a court instructed authorities to clear the area over 6 years ago. The Army Radio did not specify the source of the explosives, but quoted Herzliya mayor saying, "We are being careless and it's going to cost us lives." Zionist media indicated that the site of the same explosion witnessed an explosion 31 years ago in a warehouse of explosives, killing 2 people and injuring dozens. The Israeli occupation army spokesman declared that the explosion was not caused by military activity, but rather by the explosion of a warehouse for the military industrial facility, which allows to several other hypotheses that the enemy leaders may not like.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hamza Khansa, journalist at Al Akhbar Daily newspaper and political commentator. Thank you, Mr. Hamza, for being with us. Now, there are no specific details concerning the large explosion that rocked the Herzliya area, north of occupied Jaffa, otherwise known as Tel Aviv. But it is known that the area is actually an arms ammunition warehouse. But can such an incident be deemed normal inside of the occupied entity?
First of all, thank you for hosting me on your show. Secondly, we have not yet experienced over the recent period of time similar incidents to the one that occurred from an explosion of this size in the areas of influence of the occupying entity. We are not accustomed to hearing of such spontaneous or unrelated incidents of military or warfare. In any case, the haste of the occupation entity and its authorities to impose a ban on media circulation of everything related to this incident is a usual behavior for the occupation authorities during desolation and confrontation, especially if the events are related to the so-called Israeli national security. Today, this targeted area is an area isolated from the rest of the colonial settlements. It is clear that this is an isolated military area, and therefore for such an event to occur in it is unusual and not normal. It is strange, especially in these political conditions and chaos within the occupying entity, and the high level of security and military challenges facing the occupying entity, both within the occupied interior, such as imbalances and rules of engagement that the resistance forces are hastening to impose, or external challenges coming from Lebanon and from other regions where we are witnessing a growth in the access of resistance capabilities. Because the Axis of Resistance had announced earlier its readiness to start a confrontation against the Israeli occupation entity.
But at the same time, Mr. Hamza, we see that there is trouble for the Zionist entity at the border with Lebanon and the Kfar Shuba village, especially the occupied part of it. We see more trouble in the occupied Syrian Golan Heights with protests and incarcerations. We also see trouble in the West Bank, especially in Jenin lately. Do you think the Zionist entity is capable of dealing with all these multiple fronts at the same time, especially following up in possible cyber attacks, the likes of what we saw possibly in Herzliya? I mean, can they just stand up to all of these fronts and fight back potential cyber wars inside their own territory of control?
The recent incident in Herzliya opened the door wide to many questions and scenarios drawn today by the Israeli media, analysts and military commentators about such a scenario which you now asked about. It is the occupying entity is facing war, or confrontations on several fronts and in many forms. Among them is the Lebanon front, the Palestine front from within the West Bank, which has begun to become active again, or from the Gaza front, or from all regions and geography of the axis of resistance, whose leaders declared that networking between the unity of the battlefields does not only mean solidarity in the sense of emotions and feelings, but rather by engaging in a process of deterrence, confrontation, and possibly an all-out war with the occupying entity. From here, we see the increasing Israeli fears that the superior capabilities that the Islamic Republic of Iran possesses will join in a cyber war, a war through intelligence and other advanced technologies that Iran possesses and which the occupation entity has experienced well in the near past. Even if some of the operations that affected important Israeli interests remained without an official announcement from the executing party, the occupying entity, in the context of this war, knows very well that in some of them they bore the hallmarks of the Islamic Republic of Iran. The main question for now is the occupying entity ready or able to withstand this type of multifaceted war and multiple fronts?
That's a question that I think we need to see in the upcoming months if Israel will be able to answer it, or maybe try some other sort of maneuver that went deeper into trouble facing this axis of resistance. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Hamza Khansa, journalist at Al Akhbar Daily in Lebanon and also a political commentator. Thank you very much for your contribution. And ladies and gents, thank you. I do welcome you every week for new updates from the region of West Asia right here on the Mideast Stream. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. In the limelight.
U.S. House Republicans' majority are eager to use their new oversight powers and pass a spate of bills to draw contracts with Democrats and give the Biden administration legal notices and even impeach him. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some world media for further details. Please stay with us to hear more about the story. The Daily Mail reports U.S. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas called for a congressional probe over whether to impeach Joe Biden over his son's messages with Chinese officials. Cruz, speaking on a podcast, said a string of texts show that Hunter Biden was using his access to his father to win his lucrative business deals abroad. It comes after 53-year-old first son struck a plea deal recently with federal prosecutors in Delaware over tax and firearm offenses. But Ted Cruz said Congress should open an investigation into whether the president himself was using his position to line his pockets. He said, "Look, this WhatsApp is direct evidence of Joe Biden abusing his government power to enrich his son and assuming 10% for the big guy to enrich himself." The top Republican said, "Remember, this WhatsApp says we want to know. This is not just me, Hunter, just mooching off my dad. Of course, the House needs to investigate it." But any idea that an impeachment motion would succeed is far-fetched because the upper house of Congress, the Senate, is currently controlled by the Democrats. Conservatives have long claimed that Hunter Biden has been guilty of using his family connections to rake in millions of dollars abroad. They are investigating his deals in Ukraine and China that they claim were struck thanks to the access he got to his father, who was vice president under Barack Obama. In the 2017 WhatsApp message singled out by Cruz, Hunter sent a menacing threat to a Chinese Communist Party official after Joe Biden had left the VP office. He hinted to Henry Zhao, CEO of Harvest Fund Management, that his father would see to it that he would be punished if he did not comply with the unspecified demand. Hunter Biden reportedly said, "And Z, if I get a call or text from anyone involved in this, other than you, Zhang, or the chairman, I will make certain that between the man sitting next to me and every person he knows and my ability to forever hold a grudge that you will regret not following my direction," adding, "I am sitting here waiting for the call with my father." The charges undercut consistent claims from the Biden family and administration that Joe was not involved in his son's foreign business dealings. Hunter's lawyers have insisted the WhatsApp was the ramblings of a troubled man in the midst of a drug addiction. Recently, a lawyer for IRS whistleblower Gary Shapley claimed that his attempts to get to the bottom of the WhatsApp story had been rebuffed by prosecutors. Mark Light, Shapley's attorney, said the agents wanted to follow up on this and the prosecutors told them not to because, oh well, maybe Hunter Biden was puffing or something like that. He told Fox News on Friday, June 23rd, "So the agent said, well, let's get the GPS location of the two, of the father and son, and let's see if they are actually in the same room at that time." Meanwhile, the Reuters news agency writes recently the House Ways and Means Committee released testimony from two IRS whistleblowers, including Shapley, who said the Justice Department, FBI, and IRS interfered with the investigation of the tax evasion case against Hunter Biden. Jason Smith, a Republican from Missouri who chairs the committee, claimed that testimony outlines misconduct and government abuse at the Internal Revenue Service, IRS, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI, in the investigation of Hunter Biden. He added, Whistleblowers describe how the Biden Justice Department intervened and overstepped in a campaign to protect the son of Joe Biden by delaying, divulging, and denying an ongoing investigation into Hunter Biden's alleged tax crimes. The committee said on Thursday, June 22nd, the charges point to a steady campaign of unequal treatment of enforcing tax law, Department of Justice interference in the form of delays, divulgences, and denials into the investigation of tax crimes that may have been committed by the president's son, and finally, retaliation against IRS employees who blew the whistle on the misconduct. Hunter Biden's lawyer Chris Clark, who negotiated a plea agreement on Hunter's behalf with the Justice Department, called the whistleblower biased and claimed the account covered a time of turmoil and addiction for the president's son. He also disputed the veracity of Hunter's claim about now President Biden in the WhatsApp message, saying his words have no connection to anyone in his family. Clark said an extensive 5-year-long investigation conducted by the United States Department of Justice concluded recently, which resulted in my client taking responsibility for 2 instances of misdemeanor failure to file tax payments, as well as a firearm charge, which will be subject to a pretrial diversion agreement. Moreover, The Hill newspaper reports the House of Representatives approved a resolution referring articles of impeachment against President Biden to 2 committees. The resolution directs the House Homeland Security and House Judiciary panels to examine any evidence of wrongdoing related to the president's immigration policies. It was approved along party lines. Representative Lauren Boebert from Colorado took her own leadership by surprise when she pushed forward recently with a privileged resolution that was designed to move immediately to impeach Biden. But that move led to pushback from within many corners of the House GOP conference, who say the House still needs to develop a case through the regular committee process. Some moderates also believe House Republicans should focus on passing bills showing their party can govern instead of responding to calls from their base to go after the president. Boebert introduced her measure recently that primarily focuses on immigration and border issues, charging that Biden violated federal immigration laws that led to increased migration. This came after Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, another conservative firebrand, filed an impeachment resolution earlier this year, a measure not widely supported within the GOP conference. Greene's effort also targets Biden's immigration policies. The abrupt move by Boebert threatened to derail other House action and divided House Republicans. After several meetings with key groups across the House GOP conference, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy negotiated with Boebert and other conservatives who wanted to move impeach now to instead refer their measure to the relevant House panels, Homeland Security and House Judiciary. Several GOP members stressed this follows the Speaker's pledge to follow regular order and contrast with the process Democrats used for the second Trump impeachment. Representative Garrett Graves, a top ally of the Speaker, told NPR, "I think impeachment is one of the most awesome powers of the United States Congress, and it's not something that needs to be exercised flippantly." He stressed he has huge problems with a lot of policies the Biden administration has done, but added, if anything reaches the threshold of impeachment, it needs to be taken up through the committee process and needs to be fully justified.
say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witches!
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Former President Donald Trump has been indicted for a second time. Donald Trump says he's been indicted on charges of mishandling classified documents at his Florida estate. The federal prosecution is arguably the most perilous of multiple legal threats against a former president. There are still more criminal investigations looming, trials are coming, and Trump continues to be the frontrunner for the Republican nomination. Trump's legal woes are getting worse and worse, but so does the overall political landscape in America. This is how Donald Trump described his second indictment.
Today we witness the most evil and heinous abuse of power in the history of our country. Very sad thing to watch. A corrupt sitting president had his top political opponent arrested on fake and fabricated charges of which he and numerous other presidents would be guilty. Right in the middle of a presidential election in which he is losing very badly. This is called election interference and yet another attempt to rig and steal a presidential election. More importantly, it's a political persecution like something straight out of a fascist or a communist nation. This day will go down in infamy, and Joe Biden will forever be remembered as not only the most corrupt president in the history of our country, but perhaps even more importantly, the president who, together with a band of his closest thugs, misfits, and Marxists, tried to destroy American democracy.
In a recent interview with Fox News, who uncharacteristically came down hard on Trump, the former president claims that he was too busy to sort out personal documents from top secret ones.
The only way NARA could ever get this stuff, this back, would be please, 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 could we have it back?
And they
please.
Asked for that.
Because they have no, we
they
were
did
talking.
Ask for it.
No, and
they said,
I gave
can you
them
give
some,
the documents back?
And we were talking.
And then they said they went to DOJ to subpoena you to get them
which
back.
They've never done before.
Right. And but why fairness, not just hand them over then?
Because I had boxes. I want to go through the boxes and get all my personal things out. I don't want to hand that over to NARA yet. And I was very busy, as you've sort of seen.
Yeah, but I've according very, to the indictment, you then tell this aide to move to other locations after telling your lawyers to say you'd fully complied with the subpoena when you hadn't.
But before I send boxes over, I have to take all of my things out. These boxes were interspersed with all sorts of things.
Trump said the indictment against him is nothing more than a distraction from bribery allegations leveled against President Biden. He has previously said that his legal challenges were aimed at stopping him from running for president. So Biden is accused of bribery and Trump has numerous legal woes. Who stands a moral better position?
As far as the indictments and the unjust persecution of President Trump, as he would call it, as I would as well, I believe it is 110% that it is a distraction from the bribery claims that is being leveled against Biden right now, as well as his family. If you look at the track record going all the way back to 2016, they've been after President Trump pretty adamantly since 2016, which is understandable seeing how he's not from Washington, D.C. He wasn't a politician before then. He was obviously an outsider. And they had no reins on President Trump. President Trump is his own man. He didn't need any money from them. He controlled his own purse strings. So he created a lot of enemies within Washington, D.C. Now, in terms of the bribery claims, yes, I do believe it's a distraction because if you look back at history, going back to 2016, the Russiagate hoax, that failed. They tried to take him out of the presidential election. With that, they spied on his campaign as well. There was the state indictment in New York. That didn't work. So now they're going with a federal indictment. And if you look at the law pretty closely, it doesn't hold any weight. They're just doing this to try to bog him down.
But the story of one president trying to pull down another former president is surely unprecedented in the United States history. The American public has expressed lots of sympathy for Trump, not because they believe he's innocent, but because they do know that all politicians have their own skeleton in the closet. After all, it was President Biden who hid documents in his garage.
America has spent a long time calling other governments banana republics for essentially doing what we're doing now, which is Biden is attempting to jail his political opponent. And the mainstream media is trying to paint it out to be one way with Trump, that he is, you know, definitely guilty of these crimes. And yet the public has reacted quite differently. In fact, most of the public has actually engendered more sympathy for Trump because they feel he is being persecuted by the government in a two-tiered justice system, where you look at what the Bidens are doing and what they are getting away with, or the Clintons or the Obamas, versus what they are persecuting Trump for. It seems to be an uneven application of the law. And that's where Trump has really actually gained a lot of sympathy. I posted a clip earlier of two DC liberals. One of them is from CNN, commenting on this backlash and how that has actually helped Trump. And it is giving him momentum going into the general election.
Let's see some of the public reactions towards Trump's legal woes.
I am feeling somewhat relieved. I think that I'm hoping that this is the beginning of something that will really bring down a very, very bad person.
While I support Donald Trump and I support his run for presidency, I also want people to understand that this is an American issue. It rises above whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, whether you think Joe Biden is competent or you don't. Of course, you know I don't think he's competent.
It's not a witch hunt. Do something wrong. You should be just like everybody else and have to deal with it. I have a feeling he's going to probably get a really light sentence, but that's just the way it goes.
Just think it's stupid, it's going to not get anywhere, and it will come back to be bad on the Democrats.
I think that people should focus on better topics and better issues that we have in the social climate, like people struggling on the streets, affordable housing, education, things that really matter to Americans.
Well, I kind of expected it because I saw it in the news, it was probably going to happen. I think it actually gives him an advantage going into the 2024 election.
Trump says he would totally obliterate the deep state if get elected. What exactly is this deep state, and what is its agenda?
The deep state is essentially a conglomerate of multiple organizations within the federal government that act in the way of subverting the American people. The deep state has multiple names, such as the Swamp, such as the Uniparty. These people are all the same. These people are in elected positions. They are in administrative positions, appointed positions, and they specifically do the exact opposite of what the American people and the American public want. In order to enrich themselves, whether it be by military industrial complex through defense contracts, whether it's through aid that they're funneling back to themselves, whether it's through taxes that they're taking from the American people, the Uniparty operates in a way that serves themselves and subverts the will of the American people. And that's what President Trump wants to get rid of. He wants America first. He wants, the country. He wants these systems, executive, judicial, and legislative branch, to work for the American people. And as it stands right now, they're doing the exact opposite I mean, I believe that's what President Trump means by he's going to eradicate the deep state, which would be outstanding for America.
A poll shows that most Americans believe that a deep state definitely or probably exists. Let's put aside the question of whether it does exist or not. Where does this public perception come from?
The deep state was to be rumored to be involved in the assassination of John F. Kennedy in the 60s, 1963. And for a while, the deep state had been telling you, oh, it's crazy to say that we were involved, the FBI and the CIA, in the assassination of JFK. And they told you for over 60 years that it was this lone wolf, Lee Harvey Oswald, who shot JFK. Well, just this year, the CIA released documents admitting that, yes, the CIA and the FBI were involved intimately in orchestrating the plot to assassinate a president of the United States. So when you consider the fact that the CIA and FBI just admitted their involvement in killing one of our own presidents, I believe that's where the public perception comes from, that the deep state controls America. Because in the end, if the FBI and the CIA can literally assassinate one of our presidents, then it is kind of hard to say that the president is the most powerful person on earth rather than these deep state actors who obviously control the presidents.
Trump is clearly the GOP frontrunner, and he would, at this moment, stand a better chance to defeat Biden. But many of the former president's close allies have also come down hard on him and have called for him not to run for president. They believe his legal woes are real and he's a toast.
I do think that even half what Andy McCarthy said, which is if even half of it is true, then he's toast. I mean, it's a very detailed indictment, and it's very, very damning. And this idea of presenting Trump as a victim here, a victim of a witch hunt, is ridiculous. Yes, he's been a victim in the past. Yes, his adversaries have obsessively pursued him with phony claims. And I've been at his side defending against them when he is a victim. But this is much different. He's not a victim here. He was totally wrong that he had the right to have those documents. Those documents are among the most sensitive secrets that the country has. They have to be in the custody of the archivist. He had no right to maintain them and retain them. And he kept them in a way at Mar-a-Lago that anyone who really cares about national security, their stomach would churn at it.
So many people in the Republican camp are trying to stop Trump from running for president. And of course, many in the Biden camp are working just to get him knocked down. Of course, Trump has promised to punish all those who are coming after him, especially the Biden administration.
It's because they're on the chopping block, and they know it. And there's such a clear record of what they've been doing that they know when he gets in that he's going to inform. It would be unwise for him to let it all go. Some people may think that taking the high road is the best answer, but we know that in this world and in reality, when something happens, there needs to be consequences so it doesn't happen again. And that's what Democrats realize is going to happen. They know that once he's elected, he's going to appoint a special prosecutor, and he's going to come out guns a-blazing. So, yeah, they are motivated. They do have a reason to be attacking him as adamantly as they are, knowing that as soon as he's sworn in, they're the ones who's going to have the target on their backs next. And rightfully so. They should be. Every last one of them thrown in jail in the Biden administration. But that's why, that's the reason why they specifically in the Biden administration don't want President Trump to be elected.
According to a survey, more than two-fifths of Americans believe civil war is at least somewhat likely in the next 10 years, a figure that increases to more than half among self-identified strong Republicans.
I don't think we're on the path to a civil war. I do agree that if you look at the media depiction, it does make you feel like we are on that path. But in reality, we're not as divided as we seem. It's just that the media is so effective at, one, depicting that, and then, two, actually doing a good job of dividing people further. So in the end, once we can overcome all of this censorship and the media literally being the divider, then I think actually we will, there is a very bright light at the end of the tunnel. It's just the media is what is making the situation dark. They're very effective at what they're doing. And that's why it is a great thing that what you are doing, Ali Reza, letting me on to explain this, because even in America, we do have major censorship issues and we do have a major issue of getting the truth out. So thank you for giving me this opportunity. It's a rare opportunity, sadly, in America.
Most experts believe a full-scale armed conflict like the American Civil War between 1861 and 1865 remains unlikely. Many fear an increase of jacked political division and explicitly political violence.
As far as the Civil War goes, we know that history repeats itself. Whether that's in 10 years, 15 years, or 30 years, I believe that something in the effect of a Civil War will happen. Given the way that our country is going, it is polarized, unfortunately. But when you have the administrative state against the people, something like that is bound to happen. It's unfortunate. I pray that we can stave it off as long as we can. But as far as light at the tunnel, I think that with this, with everything going on, if President Trump isn't elected and we get four more years of this administration, something will happen. It may not be as big as the Civil War, but you know, I do think there's going to be a lot of shaking up in this country if we get another 4 years of this disastrous and abysmal administration.
Interestingly, majority of Americans don't want Biden or Trump to run again in 2024. Some people say the fact that Republicans' frontrunner is Trump and Democrats are sticking to Biden, both of whom have lots of problems, show the decline of U.S. power.
I disagree with that premise because while the frontrunner of Democrats, which is Joe Biden, has completely destroyed America as we know it, I mean, we know it is not the same as it once was. It was a great country with great economy, and our social issues were not as bad. That's one thing. The other one being President Trump as a GOP frontrunner is doing what we, the American people, want him to do. The majority of the American people want the country back on its feet, back thriving, prosperous, our economy, we want that back. I mean, we want these ridiculous social issues to go away, and there's only one route towards that, and that's President Trump. So, no, I don't think that he chose the decline of America by running. I think that he's actually trying to do the exact opposite. The only one who's choosing the decline would be, you know, the party putting up the person who's actually destroyed this country the last 4 years. Now, they could have put, Kennedy, RFK, Jr., who's running for the Democrat presidential election. They could have had him up there, and I think that would have been a much better choice, somebody sensible. That would not have been a choice of decline in America, but because they chose Biden, I think that they made a willful decision in where they want this country to go. In their heads, it may be, you know, somewhere else, obviously not a great place, but for the rest of America, it's President Trump is the one who is trying to lift up this country and bring it back to where it once was, which was a...
Trump says the escalating Russia-Ukraine crisis never would have happened on his watch. He's also vowed to end the conflict in 24 hours. But would a Trump presidency change the course of the war? Would we see a dramatic shift?
The dramatic shift would be an end to the war. A lot of people actually believe President Trump when he says that he would have that war ended within 24 hours. I think that that may be a stretch. I think it would probably take, you know, at the most a week, because there's a lot of negotiations and talking that have to go on. But I believe that, you know, very shortly after he's elected, that war, there will be a drawdown. There will be a drastic drawdown, because not only it won't be just the fact that he has to go and negotiate. Other countries are watching this election. I mean, they're watching this war, and they know that President Trump had absolutely zero wars during his administration. First president in decades for that to happen. Zero wars, zero conflicts, and was a peacemaker. Peace in the Middle East, you know, peace, you know, in North and South Korea, passing demilitarization zones. So I think that we know that we have a candidate who is skilled in the art of foreign diplomacy and getting these wars to draw down.
Trump was impeached in 2019 partly because he had pushed Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to investigate Joe Biden, then one of his top political rivals, while freezing about $400 million in vital military aid to the former Soviet Republic. Experts say Trump's amicable disposition toward Putin and disdain for international and democratic norms emboldened the Russian president.
You look at modern American presidents, and every modern American president but Trump has seen a situation where we ceded land to Putin. So Trump is the only person, you know, George Bush ceded Georgia, and Obama ceded more land, and Biden with what he's doing, plus Afghanistan. You know, Afghanistan really did contribute to the Ukraine war of how we withdrew. We left all those weapons, and we showed how weak we were. And so all of those things contributed to where we're at now, with Putin feeling a sense of strength and, you know, and feeling, oh, this isn't going to be that hard. And in the end, he already achieved his goals. Putin achieved what he already needed. He wanted a warm seaport, and he already got it. Trump obviously never had Putin advance on land for a reason. And Trump would end the war in a dramatic fashion, because he would actually be able to negotiate with Russia and also end the other piece of this, which is China. China is the other side of this that people don't talk about. As Russia acted, China acted in accordance and started attacking India. And so in the end, Trump is going to stop the massive Asian land war that is occurring. And again, Afghanistan was key in this. Once Biden left Afghanistan and abandoned Afghanistan, Putin understood, oh, America is weak, and this is the time to do this.
America is divided economically, politically, and culturally. Income inequality is at virtually unprecedented levels. Political polarization has risen to new highs, and we are sorting ourselves into distinctive cultural tribes that increasingly live in different communities. For many, this is just some indications of a power in decline.
I would agree in the sense that you're clearly seeing that the people's power and who they want to see run for president is clearly being ignored. And as the American people continue to be ignored in what they desire and what they want in the political process, you will continue to see these issues with a decline in power, with a decline in perception of power, feeling that, oh, we're not even allowed to select the two. Yeah, there's only two. We only have a two-party system. We don't have multiple choices. It's either A or B, binary, and you can't even choose one of the two. That's what's deflating Americans. That's what's making people feel like they do not have a choice in this manner.
The election of Donald Trump didn't cause these divisions, but his presidency is exacerbating them. The Biden presidency also didn't solve these menaces. The United States today is home to two huge but essentially invisible populations. Each of them is widely stigmatized and largely composed of people living in the shadows. The government does not know who they are, where they are, or how well they're doing. The first of these invisible tribes are immigrants. Most well-informed viewers know that the number of Americans behind bars has soared since the early 1980s and that the United States has a higher share of its populace in jail or prison than virtually any other country. And they also know that these problems will not get answered no matter who is in the office.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Some Russian media say that Wagner's mutiny was organized by Western secret services. Recently, the head of Russian state television said, "There is no doubt that the recent mutiny by Wagner mercenary group against the Kremlin was organized by the secret services of the United States, Britain, and the Zionist regime." In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies to shed more light on this issue. Please stay tuned. The Hindustan Times Daily writes, "Russian President Vladimir Putin says he ordered his country's forces to avoid bloodshed during Wagner Group's armed mutiny over the weekend," adding that the West and Ukraine wanted Russians to kill each other. Putin said in a recent televised address to the nation, "From the start of the events, on my orders, steps were taken to avoid large-scale bloodshed," adding, "Time was needed, among other things, to give those who had made a mistake a chance to come to their senses, to realize that their actions were firmly rejected by society and that the adventure in which they had been involved had tragic and destructive consequences for Russia and for our state." The Russian president also lauded his fellow countrymen for their endurance, unity, and patriotism. Putin added, "It was precisely this fratricide that Russia's enemies wanted, both the neo-Nazis in Kiev and their Western patrons, and all sorts of national traitors. They wanted Russian soldiers to kill each other." He warned that any attempt to sow unrest in Russia would fail, saying, "Civilian solidarity showed that any blackmail and any attempts to organize internal turmoil is doomed to fail." The Russian president also thanked Wagner fighters and commanders who stood down to avoid bloodshed, saying he would honor his promise to allow them to relocate to Belarus if they wanted, or to sign a contract with the defense ministry, or simply return to their families. The Russian president said virtually the entirety of Russian society was united by its responsibility to defend their homeland, adding that most Wagner fighters were patriots who were used by organizers of the mutiny, adding the organizers of the mutiny having betrayed their country, their people also betrayed those whom they dragged into the crime. They lied to them, they pushed them to death. Meanwhile, the website of Deutsche Welle reports President Vladimir Putin has lauded the swift and effective response of the Russian army and security forces during the recent armed mutiny by the Wagner paramilitary group, preventing the nation from plunging into a civil war. Addressing some 2,500 members of the military, the security forces, and the National Guard inside the Kremlin's Cathedral Square on Tuesday, June 27th, Putin said they de facto stopped the civil war over the weekend. Putin told the troops, "You saved our homeland from turmoil and actually stopped civil war," adding, "You have defended the constitutional order, the lives, security, and freedom of our citizens. You have saved our motherland from upheaval." He said that an unspecified number of Russian military